This is the Alembic Files. It's Eric the Blacksmith. This is, yes, it is, number 13. Oh, no, not that number. Of Phantasms of Freedom. And is from what Eric has told me, he's going to take a look at the situation back in the late 18th century, in the early years of this country, and the perspective from what he called the guy in the trenches, the little guy. And tell us more about this, Eric.
Hey, Al. Yeah, we're up to a baker's dozen.
Yes, that is true. Yes.
The little guy and just how he was exploited in many respects. And in looking around, I found some interesting accounts from a battle that occurred in my neck of the woods, the Battle of Groton Heights, which took place on September 6th of 1781. And this is when Benedict Arnold, who had turned, burned the town of New London, and he crossed the Thames River to Groton, Connecticut, and he attacked a colonial outpost that was at a Fort Griswold. And I have a poem here of Leonard Woolsey Bacon. This was delivered on the occasion of the centennial celebration, September 6th, 1881. And it gives what I think is a pretty good account of the participants from their point of view, and of course how the moneyed masters and the elites and the throne and the crown, of course they're all in the same, you know, crust, really took advantage of the situation, and how the crown just really didn't give a damn about the little guy. So, without further ado, let me start. And this was given at the occasion of the centennial of the battle. And oh, if you look at the website for Fort Griswold, you will see the obelisk there. There is an obelisk. Probably about 130 feet tall, and they just, a few years back, they did refurbish it. The word went forth from the throne, desolate, desolate, smile, burn, destroy, till their woes shall atone for the woe and shame of the state. They have shamed the arms of their king. They have flouted the terms we bring. High time that vengeance should have full swing over small and great. Reap down their crops with your swords, harry, ravage, hound on the rage of your hireling hordes, Hessian and savage. Of our grace we have offered them oft fair terms of submission. They have scorned our words and scoffed at reserve and condition. They are reaching out hands to France. They welcome our foes' advance. Go, Clinton, dance those rebels a dance to perdition. So the blaze of Fairfield flushed the sky. New Haven's smoke went rolling high. Far Norwalk cried with a bitter cry, and the sons of the Puritan pioneers saw the toil and thrift of 100 years spoiled in an hour. An answering flame blazed back from patriot hearts and true, and scorched with a terrible wrath and shame the Tory and traitor crew. The governor's face grew sad in his store on Lebanon Hill. He reckoned the men he had. He counted the forts to fill. He traced on the map the ground by river and harbor and coast. Ah, where shall the men and the guns be found, lest the state be lost? The brave state's sons were gone on many a field that lay. They were following Washington, afar down Yorktown way. The men and the weapons failed. They were gone with our free goodwill. But Jonathan Trumbull never quailed in his store on Lebanon Hill. There was New London Fort, and the fort on Groton Height, and the rich and crowded port, but where were the men to fight? Might it not be we had erred to care for our home so ill? Nay, never a word of such grudge was heard on Lebanon Hill. Remember, citizens, and if ever the ill thought comes, to wreck less of the broad great land, and more of your own small homes. Think of your father's dust. Think of their brave goodwill, and the Puritan governors toil and trust on Lebanon Hill. Well, on the last, well, at last drew on the day, dark with ill omen, off the mouth of the bay, flapping their wings in the gray, like carrion birds they lay, the ships of the foemen. To talk of defense were wild. We were plundered, burned, beaten, defiled. They spared not the old, nor the sick, nor the child, nor the woman. Not so spake Ledyard, brave soul, our noble commander. O history, point on your roll. To a nobler or grander, he stepped from his farmhouse door, a hero like those of yore. Oh, fair was the look of grace that he wore, and of candor. How now briskly he spoke to his troops, not a sigh, not a frown, no thought, or of fears, or of hopes, but of honor and duty alone. No question of gain or loss, only home and the righteous cause. So he signaled the handful of gunners across from the battery under the town. Few, few in the big redoubt, the sons of the Puritans stood, and over the parapet wall looked out beyond the fringe of the wood. Saw the enemy's blood-red lines uncoil and wind out snake-like over the soil. Heard the shrill fifes piping scorn, saw the steel flash back the morn, and the cruel cross before them borne, the cross in a field of blood. Looked townward over the bay, among the country roads, saw women and children running away with bits of their household goods, saw the redcoats and Hessians dragging through the dust and mire, the spoil of their poor possessions, and at last they saw the fire. And the colonel, with glass in hand, saw the hateful sight of all, as the burying ground he scanned, high over its terrace wall. He saw that nameless traitor stand on the Winthrop's tomb to give command for the deeds that his own black heart had planned in its bitterness and gall. Did the stones stir under his tread? Did a cry break forth from the dead? Did the Winthrop's dust rise up to fling the sacrilege off the bed where it slept in a Christian hope? Was it a voice from the tomb? Was it these scenes of his youth that crowded that shameless brow with gloom, that softened his heart to ruth? What moved the mind of the nameless wretch to send his orders across to fetch the regiments back? In sooth, 'twas too late. The terrible fight had been fought and lost, the brave, brave fight for the right, here upon O Groton Height. And oh, the cost! Men came from the smoldering town, from the woods and the hills came down, when the enemy had crossed, and here in the autumn weather lay the dead all tumbled together, stripped and mangled and tossed. The gray-haired men and the boys were seen where they poured their blood on the trampled green and quenched the train to the magazine. And mid the dead hutch, faint groans were heard from far down the road, groans of strong men in anguish where the horrible wagon load, heaped with wounds and with broken bones, had been plunged down over the pitiless stones, and they brutally left our gallant ones to languish. 20 widows of Groton town walked mid the corpses up and down, turned the dead faces up to the light, calling, calling into the night, listening for word or voice from husband or father or boys, waiting, speaking, questioning, seeking over the torn sod reeking with the blood of Groton Height. And there by the sally port, where the foe had entered the fort, lay Ledyard, gallant knight, his bosom gored by his own brave sword, and his hero blood on the ground outpoured for the right. My apologies for the length of that, but that was basically a local, if I remember, it was a local poet who wrote that. And I think it captures the anguish and the tumult, and of course the traitor is Arnold. He's referred to in that poem. And I think there were many accounts of, guys would be sitting around the campfire and they would be talking about, Cousin John, he was stabbed to the heart, just like Colonel Ledyard. He handed his sword over to the British commander to surrender, and this was Colonel Ledyard, and right on the spot he was stabbed, and they do have that spot right on the grounds of Fort Griswold. And it is open to tourists pretty much year-round, and they have the museum there and a little shop, and of course you can climb up the monument. That is available to climb up. And I've been up there a few times. Nice view.
Yes. And this was Arnold's doing, was it not?
Yes.
Yeah, he smoked the Groton, and did he torch New London too?
Well, he torched New London, and this was the fort in Groton that he did attack. He didn't. I don't think he lit Groton alight, but he did attack the fort, which was manned by colonials, and the accounts really were pretty. Even this loss was considered a victory, the way they wrote about it. And this was a book that I found on Amazon.com, and they pretty generous with the pages that they show. And basically, they were saying because it was done in the spirit of the revolution, it was a victory. They talk about Winthrop, who I believe was governor of Connecticut. But there was an account in Military History magazine that I used to subscribe to. I haven't subscribed to it for a while, but they talked about on the New London side when Benedict Arnold was about ready to cross the Thames, a woman grabbed, I believe it was her husband's flintlock, and attempted to shoot Arnold twice, and the gun misfired.
Divine providence, no doubt.
Divine providence. Yeah, this was in that article, and I have not found it. I've looked for it. I'll come across it. I'll scare it up somehow.
Let me throw in this real quick, because, you know, I made mention last time out that I had done some research for a magazine article I was writing about the Hudson Valley, and I had made mention of, you know, being at West Point. That one time when I was umpiring a game, but it was on a foggy, very kind of atmospheric day, right? You remember that? So,
I think so, yes.
During that research, I found out some kind of interesting, and I'm going to make a long story short, but it's provocative for those who might want to chase this down because it's a great story. You remember the British spy, Major John Andre?
Well, yes, and I do have some stuff about him that I'd love to talk about, yeah.
All right, are you going to broach that today? Do you know?
Yes.
All right. I'll be careful about what I say, but what I find interesting was that Andre and Arnold had met. They were in collusion, but Andre was trying to make his way down from the Mid-Hudson Valley to Manhattan, which was British held, but you had to get through kind of the DMZ on the east side, which had some Continental Army over there because, you know, it was an old Dutch neighborhood, so to speak. And there were some sentries there that were blocking the roads. So Andre was booking down to Manhattan, and he had some plans in his boot. I'll make this really quick. And he gets stopped by colonials. And what is he? Whatever he does.
Can I interject something?
Absolutely.
Real quick
here? Do it. Yeah.
Okay. His mistake was dressing as a civilian. That was his mistake. If he had dressed in his if he had dressed in a military outfit, he probably would have been okay, because the colonials at the time figured that British spies would be dressed as civilians, and that's what
yeah.
aroused their curiosity.
All right, good point. I mean, because what he did was it was one of these things where he came down, and it was something like mentioned he was like you said, he was dressed as such, and then they said, he goes, oh, no, I'm one of you guys. And they're like, oh, yeah? Well, we want you to undress. He's like, how can you do that to me? You know, like, he was all offended and stuff. They're going, take your boots off. And he had the plans in his boot.
That's correct.
All right, okay.
He had the plans in his boots, but those guys still thought that Arnold was loyal.
No, Andre we're talking about.
No, I understand that, but see,
they thought Arnold was okay, right? I get you, because at that point he had not yet pulled off the perfidy.
They were not aware that he had turned.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Now there was a guy named Benjamin Talmadge. Okay, and here's an account of Talmadge, and he was involved with this. Okay. Talmadge, he was a major in the 2nd Continental Light Dragoons. He was commissioned in 1776, and he was Washington's chief intelligence officer, and he was promoted to colonel. And this was the Culper spy ring, and it was based on New York City and Long Island. And it was he was using the code name John Bolton. Right? And the Culper ring, this is they're thought to have revealed the betrayal of Benedict Arnold, but it's disputed. And there's not much evidence to prove that Talmadge had heard from a spy in New York City about this Arnold Andre plot. But it would have been easy for Talmadge to suspect that Arnold was basically up to no good.
Okay.
Because Arnold, he'd arranged to meet Anderson. I guess this was John Andre's alias at the time. And this is when Anderson, a.k.a. Andre, was carrying military secrets back to New York City, like you said, to Manhattan. And let's see here, Jameson. There's a name Jameson in here. Talmadge, the only thing he could do, really, was to persuade Jameson to recall Lieutenant Allen, who was already on his way, and he was going to deliver Andre into Arnold's custody. But Talmadge, okay, this is what happened. He was unable to dissuade Jameson from informing Arnold of Major Andre's arrest. Okay. Now, Talmadge, his suspicion of Arnold's treachery may not have been strong enough, as Jameson later reported in a letter to Washington that neither Talmadge nor other officers he consulted raised any objections to sending Lieutenant Allen with a message to Arnold saying Andre was now in Jameson's custody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now Arnold, I guess his contact Andre, he's caught. He's taken to North Castle. The commander, Colonel Jameson, orders his lieutenant, Allen, to take the note and the incriminating documents found with Andre to Arnold at West Point. So Talmadge, he's suspecting Andre to be a spy, and he suspects Arnold to be his accomplice. He tries to have Jameson reverse his orders, to delay his orders. He was unsuccessful. He did convince Jameson to send a rider and to take Andre to Salem, and this, I guess, was about 8 miles east of the Hudson River, and to send the documents to Washington. So, and then Allen was still to report to Arnold with Jameson's note outlining the events. So, and I guess Jameson, he was banged on by Washington because Washington, you know, because he warned Arnold and allowed his escape. And I guess what happened was Peggy Shippen, Arnold's wife, she was party to this. She knew about it, but she faked an attack. I guess she played Mickey the Dunce when Washington showed up.
Well, they let her slide anyway.
And they let her slide, yes.
And he wound up with a second wife.
Eventually what happened was I think Arnold and Peggy Shippen ended up crossing the Atlantic and going back. They ended up going over to England. And I think they were somehow spirited out of the country. And Arnold was looked at with a jaundiced eye, even by the British.
Well, you know, that's the interesting story. And it's almost like the story of spouses who, shall we say, stray. And then they hook up with the person with whom they're having the affair. But you always have to wonder, because if the one spouse left his or her wife, husband, whatever, to go with the third party in the triangle, don't you ever wonder if that will happen again? And I think that's the way it's looked at with spies. It's like, you know, well, not spies, but those who jump sides. It's like, okay, you jump sides, so what makes us think that, you know, maybe you won't do it again?
And that's exactly what happened with Benedict Arnold.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He was looked at with some suspicion by the British, and I think he's buried at Westminster Abbey, if I'm not mistaken. And he and his wife, if I recall, died early, relatively young from an illness. I'm not sure what it was. But he just kind of faded into obscurity and just lived the rest of his life in England.
I'm not so sure that Shippen's went with – I mean, he had – as far as I know, Arnold had a second wife that was in England with him. So I don't know how that all worked out. And, of course, you know, having, you know, part information isn't great. But I don't believe Arnold wound up with his original wife.
I'll have to
take a look.
I will have to look into that.
But what I wanted to just throw in here real quick, and now you bring it all back to me. Yeah, okay, Andre was in his civvies or whatever, and he goes down, and these people who stop him, these soldiers, say they're Brits. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm Brit too. And they're like, we're not Brit. And he goes, neither am I. Honestly, you can imagine, it's humorous now. And so he's like, no, I did the same thing you guys did. And they're like, and one was sure, one century was kind of like, okay, and the other was like, I don't know, take your boots off, and that's when it all happened. But
right.
It gets better because he never does get down to the ship, the Vulture, which was more downriver somewhat. But Andre apparently is also on the east side of the Hudson, and he's given a dinner for some other, I believe, Continental Army officers. And he gets his note passed to him as he's sitting at the head of the table telling him Andre just got captured. And Benedict Arnold supposedly got up with, all kinds of opprobrium and said, excuse me for a moment. He called his wife into another room, kissed her goodbye, and got on his horse, and feet don't fail me now. He boogied out of there. Yeah, he boogied out of there right then and there and got his ass out of the Hudson Valley.
Okay, I do have some information on Ms. Shippen.
Okay, what happened
after
with that?
Arnold's flight to New York City, Peggy Shippen and Arnold followed. They traveled together to London at the end of 1781, where she established a splendid home as Arnold rebuilt a trading business. In 1787, she joined Arnold in St. John, New Brunswick, where Arnold's difficulties with local businessmen eventually prompted their return to London in December of 1791.
Okay,
Arnold
right.
died in 1801, after which she had to settle his business affairs and pay off his debts. Peggy Shippen died in 1804, having borne him five children who survived infancy.
All right, I'm sorry. I neglected to see this, but Shippen was, in fact, the second wife. He was married before then.
Okay, I believe that's true.
All right, so I thought he had whatever happened,
yes,
he ditched his first wife.
You're absolutely right. It was the second wife of General Benedict Arnold, born into a prominent Philadelphia family with loyalist tendencies.
And then can you imagine Benedict Arnold's going to come back to the new country and go to New Brunswick? I mean, why don't you just go up to like Hudson Bay and die?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you serious? God. I mean, I'd be looking over my shoulder thinking somebody's going to come up the mainland through Maine and grab my butt.
Absolutely.
And secondly, it's like New Brunswick, this is what you did all this for?
Yeah.
Why don't you live in Greenland?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
There's an interesting anecdote. Actually, it's actually a memorial. This is at West Point, if I remember right, and I'm trying to recall which battle. If was this at Yorktown? I'm not sure. I don't recall the battle, but Arnold was wounded in his leg. He was wounded in his leg, and there is a memorial at West Point that doesn't mention his name, but it just mentions the leg of a soldier, or the boot of a soldier.
Yeah, that does ring a bell, that he was injured, and it also became forgive the pun, a bone of contention.
Yes.
Yeah, and anybody can read that for themselves, so we won't belabor that. But one other thing I got to tell you real quick, as you suffered my story about umpiring that game and watching the fog rise up from the Hudson River Valley and, the drum and fife playing. My wife and I went up to Ticonderoga, but we went up to Vermont and we took a ferry across and we went to the fort and we walked to the east side, which are the ramparts above the river, and you took a look at all the heavy, verdure that's there now. But it was, again, another foggy day, and it was talking about how I think the British came up the ramparts with the what is it called, the Black Watch, the Scots who played fife and stuff like that. And he said that it was so chilling for the colonials to be sitting there waiting for these guys to come out, and before they could ever see them, here's this fog, and they hear this fife coming. I mean, bagpipes coming up the hill, and I mean, you can imagine it's like, woo, it's just like scary,
Almost creepy.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a great atmosphere, and you could just imagine what it would be like. First of all, personally, I would not want to be a bagpipe player in the Vanguard coming up the hill without a gun. You know, this stuff never makes any sense to me.
Neither would I.
Yeah, what is the play here? Okay, we with the yeah. flag and the bagpipes go up first. Okay.
Well, and just a brief aside, that's one reason that the people have often asked, well, like with the Civil War, for example, how come the Civil War casualties were so high? Because there were Napoleonic tactics used with modern firearms.
More modern firearms, correct.
That's right, because with the muskets, you had the rifled barrel, which, and I liken it to the difference between a spiraled football and a curveball thrown by a baseball pitcher.
Well,
you know, a lot of the old smoothbore muskets, you couldn't hit a bull in the ass with a snow shovel with, pretty much. You know, you were good maybe out to 50 yards, but once you had the rifled barrel, I mean, they had colonial sharpshooters that could pick a guy off at 300 to 400 yards with a Kentucky long rifle. In fact, I have a Kentucky long rifle, and they are extremely accurate. It's a reproduction. Extremely accurate. It's a 54 caliber.
All right, you tell me you shot it then.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Is that black powder?
Yes, it is. It's a flintlock black powder.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's a patched round ball.
Well, the thing about the Civil War, and I think this is pretty much represented by not only Antietam, but also Spotsylvania, when my wife and I were on a honeymoon, our idea of a good time was to go down to Kitty Hawk and the Nags Head and the White Beaches of North Carolina, which is really very little known but very beautiful. And we worked our way back, and we hit a lot of Civil War battle sites. And we went to Spotsylvania, if you've ever heard of the Bloody Salient.
Yes, I think.
I mean, these cats, Confederates and Union soldiers, were basically shooting each other, like, right across the salient. I mean, both parties had gunpowder burns on their faces.
So that's right.
It was like sticking guns to each other's face. I mean, that's how close the fighting was with these long rifles.
It was point-blank, practically a point-blank range.
Exactly. And I'm looking at this land, and you try to envision, I mean, it's so pastoral and beautiful, and birds are singing, and there's no sounds of cars or anything. And you look at it, and you say to yourself, how in the world could this have been a place, you know, almost, you know, ultimate, like, I don't know, hellacious, like, you know, slaughter. I mean, it's just, I mean, I can't even find the words for it, but it's like, how could it be, you know, so transformed into a killing machine?
Carnage and chaos.
Yeah. God. You know, and I mentioned that about Bloody Lake, which is now called Hessian Lake, up by Bear Mountain. I mean, can you imagine a body of water that was incarnadined, I think the word is, by blood of the people that were wounded and fell in the lake? Are you serious? Christmas.
That's an almost biblical description.
Oh, boy, you hit it right on the head. It is apocalyptic in nature, yes.
Yep.
So, anyway, I mean, and I have to tell you also that there is Andre was hanged in Tappan, New York, which is right across the line from Old Tappan, New Jersey. However, there are restaurants in Old Tappan, one of which preserved beautifully is a real colonial, you know, bread box type of thing. That's where Andre was tried. So you could actually go into the restaurant where Andre was tried. And I don't know if there is a restaurant where he was hanged, but but they kept those buildings pristine. And my wife told me, because she's gone back for the last visit, and she says it's still as preserved and as beautiful as it ever was. So,
you know, I've not been at those specific spots. I want to check them out someday, though.
You really should, I'll tell you, because when you're in that little neighborhood as much as, you know, as large as it is, just to look around, you say to myself, oh, my goodness, like, what happened here, you know? And I'll tell you another place that reminds me of that to a great extent is Harper's Ferry. When you think about John Brown and that shootout that took place there, and you go down to that place.
1859.
Huh?
1859, I believe.
Yep. I'm saying yes because I believe that is the correct date. And that's when Lee was still a Union soldier.
Okay.
Yeah, he came up from the West, and they had the shootout in town. And, I mean, the town is still preserved as it was that day. And you take a look around, and it's just so absolutely bucolic and quaint, or whatever you want to call it. And to think about what took place before then, it's like mind-boggling. And that's the way it is with a lot of Civil War sites, too, in the East. Because you take a look now, and it's just so beautiful. And you're like, how much blood was soaked into this ground? Oh, my God, you know?
Well, and that's very similar to Fort Griswold. You know, the fog's coming in off the Thames, and you're standing on the hill, and it's very bucolic and very peaceful, and you realize that, you know, there was a bloodbath here during the Revolution. You know, certainly a smaller scale than what happened at, Spotsylvania and
Tietam.
Some of the other spots.
Yeah. And, folks, I actually don't apologize for reminiscing like this with Eric, because if you're anywhere near that area, you should really avail yourself of these places, because if you have the background in your head already, I don't want to use the romance in a sense, because when you're dealing with, obviously, with warfare, that's not kind of like the right adjective, but you can just soap it up, and it does exist. And if you go up there and do a trip or whatever, I really do believe that the history actually speaks to you in those places. And I believe, Eric, you've said the same thing for what you've seen also in Connecticut. And I don't know if you hit the Hudson Valley at all, but
I've been through it. I haven't been to any of the sites that where anything occurred, but it's beautiful, absolutely gorgeous.
Yep. So I do miss it. At any rate, now that I've gotten all nostalgic and weepy, move on.
Yeah, I do recall. When I was a kid, in fact, at Fort Griswold, they did an educational film where they reenacted the battle. And I'll make a long story short. They ended up throwing us all off the set because we made so much of a ruckus.
Now,
it was something like a half an hour film for classrooms and such. And I remember, some of the guys there with their muskets letting me fire them, and at that point I just got bitten by the bug, the black powder bug, and it never left me.
Do you do reenactments to this day?
I did with the Lebanon Town Militia. I did for a time.
Okay.
And I'm hoping to at some point get back into it, but I think more on a solo level, where I would show up at a rendezvous or a skirmish and just have my own persona with my own tent and camping gear, because it kind of got to the point where with some of the groups I was with, it was powder horn in one hand and grog in the other.
I'm all for that.
Draw your own conclusions. Yeah. So I figured I'd kind of go solo after a time. I don't get me wrong. I had a lot of fun with these guys, but the politics could really get, as usual, the politics could rear their ugly heads. But I still love to shoot and to work on the accoutrements and the sutlery. In fact, in my blacksmithing classes, I'm going to be making some camping gear, the grills and the S-hooks and the tripods and all that kind of thing, probably starting later this month.
I also want to make quick mention, so get ready for your next segment you're going to bring up here while I bore everybody with this. But down here in Florida, my wife and I went on this trail to Fort Hillsborough. I don't think it was called Hillsborough at that time, but the point was that this is where everybody's kind of familiar with Osceola. They kind of know that name. To a certain extent, it's kept alive because he and the Seminoles are the nickname of the Florida State football team, well, of all sports, okay? But what I was going to say is that Osceola went down to this fort, and he had been insulted by this American Indian agent, Thompson. And at that fort, they ambushed Thompson and everyone else. I mean, they shot Thompson something like 38 times. I mean, Osceola was not in the line of chieftains. He was not in the bloodline of a chief. In fact, he was a half-breed, for lack of a better word. He was part white. His name was Powell. But at any rate, he was, I think you could call him like a Frank Nitti. He was a hitman, and he earned his stripes being that way, and they followed him because he was fearless. So the point is that we went down to this fort, and you walk along this trail, and you're really following just a little bit of a path, and out of the woods jumps this guy in like 1831 Army uniform, all right? And he will not break character. I mean,
wow.
He spoke in that kind of English at that time. He goes, you know, where are you going? And everybody's like, what? And he would not break character. And he led us into the fort, and then they gave a tour. It was outstanding. But the reason I bring it up is, can you imagine walking down some path where all this stuff had happened, as you might in New England or the Hudson Valley or Connecticut, you know, and all of a sudden this guy pops out, you know, with the flintlock, the whole nine yards, and he would not break character. That, I mean, it was outstanding. Can you imagine that?
He just stayed in persona, huh?
Yeah, anybody wisecracked, I mean, he would not, nope, wouldn't regard it whatsoever. And eventually, you know, the one or two people that said something understood that, okay, we got it, you know, this is what it's about. And they, you know, and they, I wouldn't say played along, but you let him do what he did. And he brought you into the fort and the whole nine yards. It was tremendous. But for him to pop out like he did, we were like, whoa. The good thing is that a Seminole didn't pop out. then it would have been a Freddie Flintstone, you know, da ba da ba da boom, you know, goodbye.
Yeah, for sure.
But, I mean, when history comes alive like that, even though, unfortunately, too many times it involves tragedy, it still is, I mean, just, it just comes so alive that it makes history books just pale. I mean, history books can only do what they can do. But when you see it in that kind of representation, oh, wow, it was excellent. So anyway.
We did, I just brought back a story to me that we did a reenactment up for Salem, Connecticut's tricentennial. And we had the Brits versus, you know, the Colonials. I was one of the Colonials. And usually kind of an unwritten rule in skirmishes, if your musket doesn't go off, if you're firing against another line, you go down as injured. And that's what I did. You know, flash in the pan, nothing happened. I go down. So I'm laying on the ground, and this little kid comes up with his mom. I mean, this kid must have been 3 years old, three, 4 years old. And this just really... I still think of this. So he looked really scared, like, oh, my God, this guy's dead in front of me. I says, oh, no. I said, you know how you like to play cowboys and Indians? I said, well, this is cowboys and Indians for grown-ups. And he completely understood. It was his mom was sitting there just beaming, and they just walked on.
Well, in the Northeast, I'm surprised the kid didn't kick you in the chops.
Yeah. Maybe he was from Jersey. I don't know.
I was going to say, oh, yeah, bang. Okay.
You got a problem with that?
Yeah. Hey,
but it just, you know, it just,
that's great.
Almost on an
yeah.
instinctual level, this little guy understood. So, you know, I was looking at I found an interesting author by the name of Carl Van Doren, and he wrote a book called The Great Rehearsal. And this is, I wanted to mention this because this, of course, deals with the guy in the trenches who fought the battles and, you know, may be kind of wary of this new constitution. And he has, say, a friend who's writing anti-federalist information and treatises and missives. And he's wondering why they're not appearing in his local paper. Well, Pennsylvania anti-federalist speeches, they were never printed. A lot of them, because the convention shorthand writer, Thomas Lloyd, a guy named Thomas Lloyd, and this is in Carl Van Doren's book, quote, appears to have been bought off by the Federalists and published only speeches by the Federalists Wilson and McCain, unquote. And he makes allegations in New York and elsewhere that the Federalists engaged in mail tampering. Now, he wrote another book also, called The Secret History of the American Revolution, and I was able to find it on archive.org. I don't have a Kindle account, but I do have some Adobe software which will allow me to read it. Because it is copyrighted, I don't think I can print it, but I can read it, and it offers some pretty interesting information about the events leading up to Benedict Arnold's turning of coat. It's a gold mine, Al. It really is. And I will send you the link. And he also talks about the Great Rehearsal. And this is something that we discussed before about how the 13 colonies were sort of a mini New World Order or a mini confederation of countries. And this is what Carl Van Doren writes, and I think the parallel here is amazing. The most momentous chapter in American history is the story of the making and ratifying of the Constitution of the United States. Oh, by the way, Carl Van Doren, I think he lived from like 1880 to 1950 or so. So, and I don't think these books are in print anymore. The Constitution has so long been noted, so long been rooted so deeply in American life, or American life rooted so deeply in it, that the drama of its origins is often overlooked. Even historical novelists who hunt everywhere for memorable events to celebrate have hardly touched the event without which there would have been a United States very different from the one that now exists, or might have been no United States at all. The Constitution was made and ratified during one of the two periods of American history in which the American people have been most occupied with fundamental principles of government. In 1787, the problem was how the people could learn to think nationally, not locally, about the United States. In 1948, the problem is how the people can learn to think internationally, not nationally, about the United Nations. The present problem has turned many minds back to 1787 in search of a historic parallel to serve as an example. In that year, the former colonies of Great Britain, now independent states, were recovering from a war. This is what he writes here. During the war, they had been drawn together by a common danger, but afterwards they had sagged apart. The confederation under which they lived was not so much a government as a league of states in which the individual states retained a large part of their sovereignty. And he goes on here. But there's a few more sentences, but then he says, the situation was, in any number of respects which can be seen at a glance, much like that of the sovereign states of the United Nations in 1948.
Wow.
Which brings me back to many of the discussions that you and Theo have had about this experiment being sort of a mini New World Order.
To give credit where credit is due, though, it was Harry, my first partner, who had, okay, had said it to me, and I believe Harry likes his history, and I don't think he would do any kind of gamesmanship on me, but he had said to me, could it be, and I think he did this off the cuff in one of the shows we recorded, he goes, could it not be that what they did with the 13 several states as a federation, was that not, in a sense, a little dry run for what would be a world federation later? And if that's too much of a stretch, I think I can understand that. But still in all, you cannot deny that anybody who's going to go back in history and be real about this understands that the 13 states, being called several states, wanted definitely to be apart and not joined. And so with the Constitution, as we all know, that federated all the 13 states under a central government, correct?
That's right.
And that's your understanding also of what took place there. And by the way, that Van Doren name rings a bell with me, and would you imagine why?
I can't guess.
Well, by the way, he died in Torrington, Connecticut, not far from you in a sense, I-91, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
91, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, Tarting is up, I think, by Hartford, I think. he is the brother of Mark Van Doren, whose son Charles got involved with the game show rigging that brought him down. Do you remember this at all?
Yes. I do recall not the details or the specifics, but I do remember hearing something about game shows that were rigged. And there was a giant scandal about that, and some heads rolled, from what I understand.
Yeah, and Charles, like I said, Charles, who wrote that book, also collaborated in one of those works with Mark, who I believe was an English professor at Columbia. And it was his son, Charles, also I think a professor at Columbia, who got involved with the rigging. I think it was a $64,000 question on which Dr. Joyce Brothers appeared also. And I think Jack Norris was the host of that, and he got blackballed after that show was found out for having rigged the situation and didn't come back until, like, the late 70s or 80s with Joker's Wild or whatever. I mean, I know I'm really going crazy here, but, you know, all roads lead to Kevin Bacon, so. But when you said Van Doren.
When they don't lead to Rome, they lead to Kevin Bacon.
That's right. And, I mean, when you said Van Doren, I went, oh, wow, I got to check that out. And Charles did collaborate with Mark on at least one work. And like I said, they were brothers, so.
Okay. So I didn't know that.
Yes, all this minutia. I mean, how can anybody live without this? This is why you listen to the Olympic Files, damn it.
Well, which reminds me of a name in history. Let me see if I can recall it here. Myron T. Fagan.
Yes, the famous tapes where he calls Martin Luther King Martin Lucifer King.
Martin Lucifer King. And I guess he was quite influential back in Hollywood, and he does talk in one of his speeches about a letter or three letters that were sent they were sent by John Quincy Adams to, I can't remember the guy's name, but basically warning him about Thomas Jefferson and his attempt to undermine the Masonic lodges in the United States.
Well, that's interesting. I had listened to Fagan's audio and I had read the transcripts. Have you done that?
Yes, I have.
I did that early in my Patriot days, but I had no idea that he had spoken to Adams. Are you saying warning of TJ?
Let me see. Yes, let's see if I can find it here.
Which, by the way, I had no problem with.
No. He also wrote, or he did a treatise on what he called Red Stars Over Hollywood, where he talked about what he called the Reds. And in his original treatise, I think he came out in 1967, I felt that he got it to a large extent, but he didn't follow the trail all the way back to that little nation state in Rome. I think he got most of the picture, but I don't think he got the whole picture. Of course, knowing what we know now, we can say that, because he seems to stop at the internationalist bankers. He does mention briefly the Jesuits, but I don't think he tied it together.
Okay.
Which I think he did some good work. I think that there was an element of racism to some of his philosophy. Yeah, Al, I found an interesting excerpt from Myron Fagan's treatise. Now, here is something that will stun and very likely outrage many who hear this, but there is documentary proof that our own Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton became students of Weishaupt. Jefferson was one of Weishaupt's strongest defenders when he was outlawed by his government, and it was Jefferson who infiltrated the Illuminati into the then newly organized lodges of the Scottish Rite in New England. Here is the proof. In 1789, John Robison warned all Masonic leaders in America that the Illuminati had infiltrated into their lodges, and on July 19, 1789, David Poppin, president of Harvard University, issued the same warning to the graduating class and lectured them on how the influence of Illuminism was acquitting on American politics and religion. And to top it off, John Quincy Adams, who had organized the New England Masonic Lodges, issued his warnings. Adams wrote three letters to Colonel William L. Stone, a top Mason, in which he exposed how Jefferson was using Masonic Lodges for subversive Illuministic purposes. Those three letters are at this very time in Wittenberg Square Library in Philadelphia. In short, Jefferson, founder of the Democratic Party, was a member of the Illuminati, which at least partly accounts for the condition of the party at this time, and through infiltration of the Republican Party, we have exactly nothing of loyal Americanism today, unquote. And by the way, I did look for those letters at Wittenberg Square Library in Philadelphia, and they're nowhere to be found.
All right, now you did this externally, right? Or did you actually go there?
Huh? No. Via the internet, I tried to find an account of the letters, and they said, oh, we can't find them. We don't know where they went.
All right.
So I don't know when they disappeared. I have no idea. If this was if this story is apocryphal, but something tells me, knowing Jefferson, I don't think so.
Well, you know, there's all kinds of stories, and they're really kind of believable because you want to believe them. But one you might have come across this too. I can't remember the website. but it had something to do with the fact that somebody mysteriously, you know, in the night presented Jefferson with the images that would soon be engraved on what we now know as a dollar bill. I don't know. But, I mean, I think it's fair to say that Jefferson was no, you know, he's considered the Renaissance man. I mean, bullshit. I mean, he couldn't care less about regular people. He was, I mean, I cannot find a greater hypocrite and not two-faced. He was like quad-faced. I mean, he is just, I mean, he's the most, anybody who writes a Bible and decides to excise what God had in there, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, dude, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean,
I think it'd be safe to say he's kind of in the dirt room right now.
Say the least. So I mean, yeah, I mean, and the other one who's a hypocrite, I mean, or at least is portrayed as something that he was not, was Hamilton. I mean, my goodness, really?
Oh, he's mine.
But remember something too. What's unbelievable is that Hamilton was killed by Jefferson's vice president.
Yep. Weehawken, New Jersey.
There you go.
In fact, in the book, there is an illustration, Royce and Hologram of Liberty, the second edition. He gives the link to that YouTube. There was a commercial about Got Milk.
Okay.
And there was, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a commercial for milk, and they call, random call, this was this prize, the guy could win $10,000 if he could name who won the duel. And they called the historian who researched the duel, because he had the effects. Basically, the guy knew as much about the duel as he knew about his life. So the guy on the phone is saying, well, who won the duel against Hamilton? And because his mouth is all filled with crackers and cookies, he's going like, er-boo. So, and he, you know, says, sorry, sir, you lose, you know, and it's, this ad was good. Well, he has in his book a link to the YouTube of that commercial, which I...
Well, I always thought it was interesting because if you looked at, like, when they got together for the coin toss... And I'm thinking about an NFL referee. All right, call the coin, you know, and Hamilton calls it. All right, Mr. Hamilton, which way do you want to walk to? Well, I want to walk to the woods. That's great. He turns around, looks at the rising sun in the east. Can't see Burr and gets his ass shot off anyway.
Well, Hamilton was so sure he was going to lose
that he wrote out his will. He wrote the will out.
Yeah, I think you'd mentioned that in a previous installment. He wrote out his will.
Yeah.
And there was something else he had done as far as his motivations for why he wanted the Constitution. And, you know, he certainly, as I've mentioned before, there's certainly evidence that shows he was just a total bankster's tool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was not an everyman. Get out of here. I mean, not that he, you know, Jefferson has been called an everyman. That's baloney, too. But, you know, in this case, you know, no, Hamilton was an elitist. And, you know, here's the thing about it. You know, we've got anecdotally, but I think it does add some color to what we're doing. And as a lawyer, I say, yes, you know, it's admissible. Or a judge, yes, objection overruled. Anyway, but seriously, I mean, when you think about all this stuff and you start to pump in some, like, what I would say some, like, truth air, you start to realize the 3D, the dimensionality of what we're talking about, and it becomes a little bit more alive than in the pages of a book, which, okay, a book is what it is. But, I mean, my goodness, I mean, what we got was so sanitized. You know, I mean, it's really pitiful because, all right, I get it. How much can you really say to the people with regard to the 360-degree arena that is the truth or the real, I mean, whatever happened? Unfortunately, but the thing that the voices that get drowned out, which I think, you've agreed to, and some others, to try to give some kind of voice to them, then you start to realize that, you know, I mean, life has always been as it is today. There's been nothing but tumult and fighting, and it never was a really peaceful situation, not from the very beginning of this country. That is just the way that things run. And we've been led to believe that it was halcyon and everything was okay and everybody's in agreement and life was just great. And that is not the case. And to say that it wasn't isn't to be a detractor of America. It's just to say, look, why don't we just understand that we are, you know, what we are today is what we've always been. And it's just the way it is. And why don't we just give a clear depiction of that, but that doesn't serve the purposes of our masters, I guess.
Al, whenever I need a reminder that Americans have indeed been propagandized, as we've said 1,000 times, into believing that they can't be propagandized, I overhear conversations in the halls at work. And I'll give you a great example about this whole situation with Obamacare. There were walking by me several people, and I believe one of the women said, well, how can you blame it on Obama? He's just a player in this whole situation. You know, it sounded to me like she kind of got it. And the guy that was walking with her, you know, this was a gaggle of maybe 4 or 5 people. He says to her, are you done? Don't you get it? It is all Obama's fault. And I just stopped in my tracks. It's like I said, I'm a shop steward, and it would have been a scene if I'd gotten involved with that. I just kept walking.
I'm sorry, you gave me a chance to jump in there. The thing is, yeah, you realize, you know, if you start something and you can't finish it, it just gets really bad. And I mean, after a while, you realize you got to pick your spots. When they're open, you give what you give, and then you go. But in situations like that, I just had a situation where I mentioned it to someone, and they were open to it. But when I said something, I said, don't you understand that conspiracies have run the world forever? I mean, to say that everything's a theory, I mean, come on. And the person looked at me, and I looked off to the side, and I could see the stare, because, I mean, they were thinking. And I couldn't say that they turned and smiled to me, but they thought, I mean, you could see they were processing it, but, you know, what are you going to do to try to all of a sudden stop and rewind what they have been indoctrinated with? And I said, it's the same as I've been too. I said, you know, I understand it. What you learned, I learned, but there comes a time when you have to realize that, you know, we've been propagandized too. And you get that gaze, and we used to laugh at that with the Unicans, who said, you know, when they realize that you're right, they get to the second level, which means, are you saying our government, like, isn't our friend? Yeah. And then it really becomes unhinged. But you know what? I mean, Eric, look, to bring it back to topic, and I mean, we haven't gone that far afield in a sense, and that is, this is why we're doing this. This is why you're doing it, to bring everybody back to the core, to the beginning, and say, listen, this wasn't, you know, bouquets and roses right from the very beginning. And there was elites, as there always have been, and there have been treacheries and double crosses, and that is just the way of the world. Why would we be any different? Yeah, I mean, your thoughts on that, Eric?
Well, Al, I mean, it's cool that you mention that, because I'm brought right back to a farmer during Shay's Rebellion. And his name, interestingly enough, was Plow Jogger. And he encapsulated the situation. And he said, quote, I have been greatly abused, have been obliged to do more than my part in the war, been loaded with class rates, town rates, province rates, continental rates, and all rates, been pulled and hauled by sheriffs, constables, and collectors, and had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. The great men are going to get all we have, and I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it and have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers, unquote. Yep.
But, I mean, you've already reached that epiphany, and this is why you're going into what you're doing, is because in order, I'm assuming, to substantiate what we now hold as our beliefs, you have to go back to find out that from the very beginnings of our country, there was always the trappings and the influences of an elite. It just comes with the flesh. There will always be some kind of oligarchy, if you will. There'll always be those who want to rule, and the ones who want to rule are usually the least fit to do so. And then you have your tiers. Has it ever been any different? I don't know that it has.
No, I don't think it has. And I'm grateful that there is enough information for me to corroborate a lot of this. I mean, okay, people can say the internet's full of a lot of crap. Yes, it is. But you know something? There's a lot of gold in that there internet.
Yeah, there is.
You know, the historical stuff, and especially for the listeners, go to the Avalon Project. There is a gold mine of information. Of course, you know, anything by The Informer, Montgomery, as we've said 1,001 times. But a lot of times with, say, the Avalon Project, they'll come right out and tell you the skinny, because they probably figure not everybody's paying attention.
So in other words, they will tell you the way it really is.
Yeah.
Now, I've not found that as far as commentary that it is a repository of documents that in itself speaks volumes is enough for me. But I mean, where have you found with some commentaries with regard to the information that's there and that kind of like flies in the face of our history books?
Well, I've seen it in forums. I can't
okay, fair enough.
Go specifically, okay. But yeah, I've seen it in several forums that says if you do want the straight, unsanitized, unadulterated history, places like the Avalon Project are worth looking at.
Real quickly, and then you can get back on the track of the information you want to share, because we're going to go 90 minutes. The person to whom I spoke about this. Now, you might call me crazy, and you would be right, but we've talked enough times we see each other a couple of times every year. I did, however, send him a book called A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman, which is a great, great historical perspective of the 13th century in Europe. Anybody who gets a chance, you'll understand where Monty Python gathered their medieval humor from. Tuchman does a great job. The late Barbara Tuchman, great job. Anyway, it was him to whom I said, you know, I understand that there are, you know, that people like goof on conspiracies. I said, but the world is run by conspiracies. Now, this is a man who's got a drill ready to go into my mouth. So how brave or stupid was I? But he's a great dentist. He's got a pair of hands, man. I tell you what. Stravinsky couldn't have matched that, but
somebody could have asked, or how drunk.
But I mean, he looked at me, and I could understand he processes it because he's an intellectual guy. You know, liberals are probably more inclined to listen to you than like conservatives, because conservatives just like have their brains nailed to like the historical record, you know, as in your textbooks. And I'm not a Dem, as you well know, and I'm not a Republican. I just said to him, I'm going, the world runs by conspiracies. I mean, come on, man. And he just, he had that look before he just went, with the drill. And I'm thinking of the boys in Brazil. It's like, oh, please, my God, don't do this to me. Anyway, it worked rather well despite my lack of discretion, I guess you could say. But, you know, when you have the opportunities, as you've mentioned, it's worth it. But there are times when you just got to walk away.
Yeah.
There'll be no satisfaction in it, and all the bad things happen after that. All right. Oh, look. So we've come to a point now where we talked about the poem, and you got the roadmap there. So please tell us where we are headed.
And I just wanted to briefly mention, and I hate to do this, but it is a perspective because it happened so recently. Mr. Mark Levin was championing the Constitution. And, of course, saying that we need to get back to the Constitution to fix all the problems, and I just kind of groan and shake my head and just go for another cup of coffee. And he talked about one of the anti-federalists, and I believe it was Brutus. And he talked about his complaints about Congress having so much power to tax. And he... sort of played up Hamilton and Madison and kind of gave Hamilton and Madison the win, as I would expect him to. But what was interesting was so much, I mean, yeah, this we never hear of this, of course, is what he didn't say rather than what he did say. Because he said, well, Hamilton and Madison, they basically stuck to their guns and they felt like that right through. And I'm thinking to myself, eh, not so. Hamilton, of course, wanted a Colossus. He thought the Constitution, even called it this, was a mere shilly-shally of milk and water until we could get something better. You know, basically, here was a guy who believed in child labor. You know, he believed that the workers were just, you know, well, along that line of Monty Python, how could you tell he was a peasant? He had shit on him.
He doesn't have shit? Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe Hamilton, the only regret Hamilton had was that the Constitution didn't give the central government more power. But Madison did sort of repudiate his Federalist views over time. He saw what had happened, and he regretted it. I mean, never mind that his records weren't revealed, the convention records weren't revealed until like 40 or 50 years later. I think I might have mentioned this in a previous installment. But just to give you an example of the subterfuge employed, these guys, they wouldn't allow their records to be presented until decades after the fact.
All right, so how different is that with all the stuff we've had with the Kennedy assassination, blah, blah, blah?
I was just going to go there.
Right. So what's the
difference?
Briefly,
yep. Very briefly going to go there, but yeah, there really is no difference.
And by the way, did I hear this correctly or read this correctly? That they're going to, like, push off that release of what they said they would push off at this date a little later? I don't know, and I hate to give legs to a rumor. But I wonder, I mean, I think they said, we'll wait. I don't know. Did you get anything on that with regard to the Kennedy releases? Okay.
No, I haven't.
Would that surprise us if they just said, we'll just kick the can down the road a little further?
Anyway, more on Hamilton. You know, he's he has a report on the public credit, and he talks about speculator holdings, and basically he's trying to defend the status quo. Why did speculators even buy the paper if it was so worthless and required nothing less than what they call the revolution in government in order to be reimbursed? Well, maybe Hamilton would see this whole thing through. He knew that his speculator buddies were going to make good. You know, Washington knew it too. So for them to see this whole thing through, I mean, they could see the dollar signs down the road, and I think that was one of the most powerful incentives for them to practice the subterfuge that they practiced, involving the lies about just tweaking the articles and going to the Constitution. I don't know if I might have mentioned this before, I might have read from this before, and pardon me if I did, but Hamilton says, there is a consequence of this maintaining interest-bearing federal securities based on vigorous taxation. Less obvious, though not less true, in which every other citizen is interested. It's a well-known fact that in countries in which the national debt is properly funded and an object of established confidence, it answers most of the purposes of money. Transfers of public debt are their equivalent to payment in specie, gold and silver. Such debt passes current as specie. The same thing would, in all probability, happen here under the like circumstances. So it seems like he's setting the stage for fractional reserve lending even before it got off the ground.
Yeah, it does. Yep. Good point. So is it any surprise? I mean, and remember, you had the National Bank incepted, and then, of course, the charter was renewed, as I think history tells us, what, once or twice, and then Jackson stopped it. And then he had, what, he had one attempt where both guns misfired. So he actually escaped the banker's assassination plot. But then eventually, you have wildcat banking, and there's always an excuse to bring everyone back into tow. So sooner or later, you get the National Bank that really the original colonists didn't want, just as much as they didn't want a central government. I think that was clear.
Yes, and back and here's something that buttresses my point about Madison parting ways with Hamilton. And this was from Douglas Adair. He wrote the he compiled the Federalist Papers. It's a paperback. I have it. Before the new government had been in operation a year, Madison became deeply disturbed over the trend of events in the national capital. In his view, the trouble lay in the activities and policies of Hamilton. Hamilton seized the opportunity during the formative stage of the new government to administer it, the term is Madison's, so that it would more closely approach his ideal of a consolidated oligarchy. With devious brilliance, Hamilton set out by a program of class legislation to unite the propertied interests of the Eastern Seaboard into a cohesive administration party, while at the same time he attempted to make the executive dominant over the Congress by a lavish use of the spoils system. In carrying out his scheme, though he personally was above corruption, which I disagree with, Hamilton transformed every financial transaction of the Treasury Department into an orgy of speculation and graft in which selected senators, congressmen, and certain of their richer constituents throughout the nation participated. As Madison watched Hamilton's program develop, he became disillusioned and bitter. In the convention, he had fought to create a constitution under which the interests and rights of every class of citizen should be duly represented and understood. Now he saw the machinery of his new government being used to exploit the mass of the people in the interest of a small minority. That's the excerpt. I don't know if I read from that before, but even if I did, it bears repeating, especially in light of the separation of philosophies over time between Hamilton and Madison. These three guys may have initially started out as on being on the same page, but I think as time went on, I think Madison saw the flaws in this whole machinery, and he began to recoil from it.
But, I mean, would you call them flaws, which would mean that somebody was really trying to do something honorable, but, like, just kind of missing something somewhere? Or is it something where it's like, no, you built something in here that is not what we want? Did I explain the difference between that enough for you to speak to that?
I think that, yes, there was probably a little bit of them saying, well, let's try to do something good here. But I think overall, I think it was certainly more self-preservation than anything else. And I think that that once they saw the dollar signs, I think they just got completely swayed into going full tilt boogie.
All right. So going back to what you had said, though, did they see the flaws in the plan, or did they see the treachery in the plan?
I thought they, you know what I think?
Yeah.
I think they saw the flaws and could live with them, and they saw the treachery and ultimately sanctioned it.
Wow. Okay.
That's what I think.
Well, then that would mean that they may have made an objection for the record, but actually said, okay, do it.
Yeah. I think that they saw what was on the table for them, and they said, you know, we're going to have to be real pricks here, but otherwise we lose everything we have. Let's just be Turks and just go for it.
All right. Not trying to lead you down a road that you don't want to go, but, I mean, as I'm following you, then I would say that Madison, despite whatever rhetoric was out there, basically just passed along and sanctioned it.
Yes.
All right, so he was part of the problem, too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
maybe he was trying to do a mea culpa, I don't know, maybe a deathbed conversion. I don't know if that's what I'd call it. But and who knows how much of it. I ask also how much of it could have been personal animosity against Hamilton.
You know, I was thinking to myself when people – I'm thinking about an audience that would say – how dare you bash Hamilton? Well, he was out there, and he was in the colonial war and all that stuff. And I'm like, yeah. But when you know that he was pretty much a Tory at heart, I'm sorry. He was an English – you know what I mean? He was a Brit through and through. You know, how much was he really at risk? And we've talked in past shows, and you know we have. And I've said this years ago about, you know, how many warring generals or leaders of whatever kind of battalions face each other and were Masons, or they were kind of like both had descendants back in England and were like, yeah, screw this. We don't have to do this. So, I mean, yeah, Hamilton seems like a dude for going out there, but he never got a drop on him. You know what I mean? And so it's like, yeah, well, okay, yeah, he was out there. I get it. He was a soldier. Huh? But really, did he get into the mix of it? Because when it really comes down to, like, duking out, I mean, you know, he finishes a distant second to Burr. So, you know what I mean?
Yes,
so in other words, it's a show, and it looks good. But really, this cat, how much was he really for a non-Britain United States? I don't think he was.
No, he did talk about the glories of a, how did he put it? An executive, a monarch, what was it, an executive monarchy. He got up on the soapbox and talked about this for something like 5 hours in, I don't know if it was June of 1787 or 1789, when they were trying to pass the Constitution, when they were involved with the convention. But he basically talked about the need for a powerful central government.
Okay, I mean, and that we do realize. And that's why it's so interesting because, you know, some flag wavers like Phelps and stuff, whom I respect for a lot of other reasons, you know, paints George Washington as being this pillar of, like, rectitude. And you have to wonder because, you know, they say the reason the bank got pushed through is because Hamilton had a contingent that was more powerful than Washington. And we're talking about the president, dude. And this is a president that you have said and you've detailed went out with – he and Hamilton went out to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, in fact, they sort of – you know, they were living high off the hog while the soldiers were sleeping without tents or sleeping bags. And, yeah, they pretty much were – they did travel with the troops, but they traveled, you know, they basically traveled in luxury.
Which is why we see so many places that Washington slept here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, in Hamilton, he was very restrained during the convention. But, I wonder if he was actually, you know, was he instructed to be that way?
Well, let me just say this, and then we'll go back to that question you just posited. But my question is, if Washington and Hamilton were not on the same page, is Hamilton the guy you want to come out and ride out to Pennsylvania with? I don't care if the whole thing is rigged. Do you want to spend that many days with that guy? I'm thinking no. All right, now.
Well, I think Washington and Hamilton were very much on the same page.
But those who were Washington huggers create this thing where Hamilton just had too much influence and support to overthrow Washington's opposition to a central bank. I mean, Washington's the damn president at that time, pretty clear to a monarchy anyway. Do you really think
Yes.
that Washington would have been suppressed by Hamilton and his droogies?
I think there's a very good chance of that. Because I think Hamilton had he was very friendly with the banksters.
But do you really believe Washington put up that much opposition? And I mean,
oh, no.
If you feel that way, yeah. No, but my point is that we got good cop, bad cop.
Well, that's exactly what happened.
Okay, Washington holds the back of his hand to his head going, oh, no, we can't have this, but I can't stop it. Like, give me a break.
Okay, I see
All right,
your point.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
All right, no problem.
Yes. The subterfuge was mind-boggling.
Yeah, and you know, oh no, he bested me. And by the way, let's go out to Pennsylvania. I don't know. I mean, Eric, all I'm saying is sometimes you have to inject, you have to stand back and look, I mean, you can actually write the thing down in a plus-minus kind of situation and say, not really, I mean, and I know you can say it's speculation, we'll never know a lot of things, but sometimes you can go ahead and list it and say, okay, human beings, think of yourself in that situation, devoid of every other, if you can, prejudice, and say, what does this tell you? I mean, come on. So anyway, I'm saying Hamilton and Washington were playing good cop, bad cop, and what was supposed to be done was in fact done. Your thoughts?
It was indeed done. And here's something to think about. Do you realize, Al, that Mr. Hamilton, he was the first Secretary of the Treasury. He had 500 employees.
At that time? Oh,
geez. At that time, 70 of them were in his own building. Now, the State and War Departments put together had less than 20.
What does that tell you about the way things are run? That is beautiful. That is beautiful.
500 employees.
In the finance department of the government. Oh, that is great.
Uh-huh.
Well, there you go. Damn. I mean, really. I mean, that is telling.
That's right. And it, 7 years after this, let's see, what was it, the age of 23, this is when all this stuff is going on. You know, and he really did get in very well, very good with the banking circles. And then there was the Committee of Style. You know, this really did further banking and mercantile interests. And Jay, he used Hamilton's Bank of New York to fund the new Congress's Federal Hall in New York City. Nothing like keeping it in the family, huh, Al?
All right, at this juncture, let me... if I can find the image, the photo, I'll put it up on the website. But this was forwarded to me by Kelly, who's the website of thinkerbebeaten.com. And there is a little monument down at the Trinity Church this day in southern Manhattan in memory of Alexander Hamilton. And as you might guess, it's an obelisk. And the inscription reads thusly: to the memory of Alexander Hamilton, the Corporation of Trinity Church has erected this monument in testimony of their respect for the patriot of incorruptible integrity, the soldier of approved valor, the statesman of consummate wisdom, whose talents and virtues will be admired in grateful posterity long after the marble shall have moldered into dust. He died July 12, 1804, aged 47. And I'm going to reach for my freaking handkerchief.
I just want to ask if it was opposite day when they put that thing up.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, Wall Street still loves the cat.
Yeah, well, here's Hamilton in a letter to Morris. And he says, mine is an odd destiny. Perhaps no man in the United States has sacrificed or done more for the present Constitution than myself. And contrary to all anticipations of its fate, from the very beginning I am still laboring to prop the frail and worthless fabric. Yet I have the murmurs of its friends no less than the curse of its foes for my reward. What can I do better than withdraw from the scene? Every day proves to me more and more that the American world was not made for me. Unquote. Maybe people finally saw through his game and realized what a pig in a poke the Federalists sold the people of America.
Well, I'll tell you, we're running out of time, and we've run out of time, in fact. But, you know, what you've made me wonder, and this is not necessarily something you have to unearth unless you do it because of the research you're doing anyway. And, you know, you have to look at a point where you start to see this change of I want to say the guard, but it's not really that. It's that you start to see the people realize it's a scam and how much they start to realize that and how that much waxes. But it only goes to a point, and then it starts to wane because it gets overrun by popular opinion, blah, 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 even on that day. So, we kind of understand, according to the research you've done as well, that there were voices that spoke out very eloquently, voices that are, you know, quite reputable. And then at a certain point, I think you start to see that recede as, you know, the basic bullcrap and whitewashing of everything starts to increase.
true enough, Al, and I will close on this one essay, actually an excerpt of an essay by Brutus Jr. This appeared in the New York Journal on November 8th of 1787.
Is he the guy you closed out with the other day?
No, that was a farmer and planter.
Okay. All right, cool. All right.
Let me see if I can find this. Okay. Quote, "I have seen enough to convince me very fully that the new Constitution is a very bad one and a hundredfold worse than our present government. And I do not perceive that any of the writers in favor of it, although some of them use a vast many fine words and show a great deal of learning, are able to remove any of the objections which are made against it. Mr. Wilson, indeed, speaks very highly of it, but we have only his words for its goodness, and nothing is more natural than for a mother to speak well of her own bantling, however ordinary it may be. He seems, however, to be pretty honest in one thing, where he says, it is the nature of man to pursue his own interest in preference to the public good. For they tell me he is a lawyer, and his interest then makes him for the new government, for it will be a noble thing for lawyers. Besides, he appears to have an eye for some high place under it, since he speaks with great pleasure of the places of honor and emolument being diverted to a new channel by this change of system. As to Mr. Publius, the Federalist, I have read a great many of his papers, and I really cannot find out what he would be at. He seems to me as if he was going to write a history, so I have concluded to wait and buy one of his books when they come out. The only thing I can understand from him, as far as I have read, is that it is better to be united than divided, and that a great many people are stronger than a few, and that Scotland is better off since the union with England than before. All I think he proves too very clearly that the fewer nations that there are in the world, the fewer disputes there will be about the law of nations, and the greater number that are joined in one government, the abler will they be to raise ships and soldiers, and the less need for fighting." Unquote. And that was, signed by a countryman. Okay, I do have the heading, number 38, Some Reactions to Federalist Arguments.
But okay, he's foretelling the justification that there will be for a new world order, a one world government.
Right.
Oh, saying there'll be less disputes? Of course there will be, because there'll be like global totalitarianism.
That's basically what he's saying, and he seems to be hinting to me that the United States, this new government, is indeed a dress rehearsal for that world government.
All right, look,
I mean, these anti-federalists were pretty smart cookies.
Well, I mean, they were realists, and of course, the point of all this stuff is that these voices were not allowed to get out in our textbooks. There was not a really fair debate in our history text in the way we were raised, correct?
Correct.
I mean, and all we're doing is saying, okay, these are the voices that weren't heard, and not because they were like radical or foolish or anything. It's just because they were another view which wasn't desired by the power structure.
That's right. I think somebody once said, I don't know if it was an interview you did with a couple of gentlemen a while back, and one of them said, history's always been a game of keep away.
Well, I don't remember that was with me, but it's still solid. Yeah, it is. That's right. Keep the people as blinded as possible to the way things really were. And we see that happening even now, because we know there'll be a record that details what happened in our lifetime as the way things are supposed to be. And though we know that there are things different, but we don't get input into the textbooks, et cetera, et cetera. So there always will be a certain censorship of information to promote what the government wishes to be disseminated. And, I mean, we can argue about that, but the point is that is the way of governments. The point that I think we have that's a sticking point is the fact that, hey, folks, in America, we're no different, okay? We're no worse, we're no different, but we think we are and we are not. Now, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but, I mean, are we kind of like on the same page?
I think we're in the same sentence.
Okay. No, I mean, and it's, we're not trying to tear anybody down. Just, like, give it to me straight, damn it. And you never have.
And you know, I went to some pretty good schools, Al. Yeah, I even went to the parochial schools, and I like to think I got a pretty decent education.
Well, that's your fault.
Yeah, I know. Sister Mary altar rail and all. But even in that case, you know, there's a lot I didn't learn. But you know what? That's okay. I can live with that.
Well, the only problem is everybody else is walking around with that information thinking that it is the Bible. And here we are today.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thank you for keeping the series going on. And I think, am I right, we're going to go on further. Is that correct?
I would very much like that.
Well, we're going to do that. And I thank you for giving voices, as we said, to those who had none. Or they did, in fact, have it. But they've been censored through time. And the point is, we're not trying to tear anything down. It's just like, do you want an equal representation of what went on? Okay, you've come to the right place. And then just figure it out for yourself. You know, we live in a corporate country just like everybody else does. You know, just don't think you're different than anyone else's. So anyway, we can go on and on, and we probably will. But this has kind of been, well, I mean, what do you do? I mean, there's not a satisfactory answer necessarily. But at least you should understand what, I mean, to me, I just want to know the way things are. And I say to that, you know, ad nauseum, and I think you feel the same way too. And those who listen to us feel the same way as well, that the fact that you can wrought any change, probably not. Not at this stage. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, and about the corporation of the United States, let me reiterate that if you want proof that the United States is indeed a corporation, go to the 1791 decision of the Supreme Court, Res Publica versus Swears. And they did rule, our good justices did rule, that the United States is a corporation.
Well, you go to Manta.com, you'll see it listed there. Seriously.
That's right, yeah, of course. Manta is, that's a great site.
Yeah, just go put it in there and say, okay, there it is. I also, by the way, called into a show with a chiropractic. He kind of gets everything that's going on, and he's excellent. Bittaker, his name is, and he's on Saturdays. He is on the internet. I mean, you can listen to him anywhere. He's on 1250 AM down here in Tampa. But he lamented at the beginning of his show that the government shut down, and he was kidding around. He goes, well, the government shut down, but damn, the IRS is still working. And we all, you know, we all understood where he came from. But anyway, I waited to the end of the show until everything kind of cleared out and we could, like, you know, maybe put in a zinger. And I called in and I said to him, I go, Doc, do you realize why the IRS still is, you know, can still function? And he goes, why? I'm going, because they are not part of the federal government. They are a private collection agency for the private bank known as the Federal Reserve. And he didn't knock it down. He's like, well, you know, just like the post office and there. And I, you know, I looked at my wife and going, I'm not going to say anything. But he, you know, he kind of got it. You know what I mean? And that's the way.
Yeah, the USPS, that's private too.
The United States Postal Service does have federal input. I mean, they, you know, they're on that system, but the IRS is not. It is completely, you know, it has nothing to do with the federal government other than it collects the taxes and gives it to the private bank known as the Federal Reserve.
Correct, but I do understand, or I have heard that, remember years ago you could go into the post office and you wouldn't see any of this stuff for sale? All you'd see is, say, the 10 most wanted?
Oh, yeah, they had the federal, yeah, they had the 10 most wanted by the FBI.
Right, now they call it the USPS. They don't call it the post office anymore. I remember hearing somewhere where this concern in Britain bought it out from the United States, and it is actually now privately owned.
Let's put it this, the United States Postal Service, it's working that way. I mean, you can see that it's failing to the point where something else is going to happen.
Yeah.
But, I mean, my point was that the IRS has never been a federally birthed organization.
Oh, no, not at all.
Right. And, you know, he kind of said that, and I looked at my wife, and I'm going, I'm not going to correct him, I'm going to let him go on. But he understood where we were going. And the reason why I said that to him was because he was going on about, well, the Queen of England, and then and she'll have everything. And I let him go through his diatribe, and I went, Doc, I said, listen, it's ironic that you should say that about the Queen. I'm saying, because if you look at the 1787 peace treaty that ended the Revolution, Doc, you got to ask yourself, if you read it, why King George drafted the terms. And I said, I got to go, take care. You know, and I mean, the end of the show, I didn't want to get into it. And it worked out okay. And we actually were in the truck. We were riding around in the truck. And I punched out the radio so we could talk to him without that, you know, crazy reverb. And and we were done. I hit it back again. And I listened to what he had to say to me, what to say in the outro. And he didn't bang on it at all. But, you know, I just have to laugh because, I mean, here's a person who kind of understands it and says things in jest about the queen being in rule of us. I'm like, well, you know, you might want to take a look at that.
Well, it's ironic because if you look at the procession, the ritual, the queen walks behind the Lord Mayor.
On entry to the city of London.
That's right. She walks behind him.
As is reported, but remember also that the crown that we often think is the British government, is actually the City of London.
That's correct.
So, I mean, when it really comes down to who runs things, the crown, as they said, is not, I mean, in Wikipedia, for whatever it's worth, and it's not worth much, you can take a look at one of the descriptions of the crown, and that's correct. It's business. It's always been business, Eric. I mean, talking about is business.
My brother-in-law used to work in the city, in London. He used to work in the city.
What do you mean, in the city of London?
In the city of London, yep, for Legg Mason. He was right there.
And
he's retired now, on a very nice retirement, for that matter.
Do you talk
but
to him?
But he had some very interesting stories to tell.
Oh, well, we'll be waiting for that.
But it is about the money. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, and in fact, I think, oh my, now you going back to Arnold, I'm thinking that Benedict Arnold wanted a position in the British East Indies Company. I don't know how that worked out, but now you get another flashback.
Yeah, there was, in fact, in this book, the name of the author escapes me. As usual, I have a terrible memory for names. Coyle? Let's see here. Oh. Secret History. Okay. By Carl Van Doren. Okay. In this book, The Secret History of the American Revolution, the British East India Company and the name of Arnold do come up in several paragraphs together. I've not read this book. I'm going to read it. So I will have some more information for a future show or two.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the process of popping that back up again, but it does strike me that Arnold wanted in on that. And I'm going to say about this, and we'll get out of here. And thanks for the overtime. I appreciate it. But that when you really look at it, the British Empire, to me, to a great extent, did not advance itself necessarily by force of arms in the beginning or necessarily primarily. What it did was try to broker trade with other lands. And in doing so, kind of got into the colony type of situation, perhaps before the peoples ever knew. I mean, how many lands that the British East Indies Company went into really had any kind of government at all, and all of a sudden, bang, they had one. Now, how did that happen? Well, because the people that were dealing with business got together, and that's what they created. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Sometimes I've wondered if Benedict Arnold wasn't resentful at George Washington because George Washington was making a killing. Here you've got Arnold, and I'm certainly not defending treason. I mean, treason is treason. I understand that. But was Arnold busting his ass with troops and everything else? And here you've got Washington with all these hundreds of thousands of acres and these millions of dollars. And here you've got this guy, Arnold, saying, hey, I'm busting my ass for you, and you're not even giving my guys frickin' shoes or tents. So at what point did he finally say, you know, screw you?
Well, you know what?
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. But I need to read more about this and learn more about just what happened with Arnold and Washington, because I don't really know as much as I'd like to know.
Well, let me say this. First of all, if we go by our measuring sticks as to the way things are, just as we said before, it's all about business. So if it's all about business, why would we not think that Benedict Arnold, who had some business acumen, was thinking to himself, you know what? I can make a whole lot more money. No, you know, I never thought about that until now. I mean, as much as I pop off about, you know, business makes the world go round, and it really does, I never thought about that that would be some kind of seducing element for Arnold. But why would it not be? Especially sure, since I just said that, you know, that he might have had some desire to get involved with the British East Indies Company.
Yep. He's seeing George laugh all the way to the bank, and he's probably figuring, well, shit, I could do that too.
Wow.
I don't, like I said, Al, I'm just thinking out loud. But I'm going to do some more, I'm going to do some more digging on this.
Okay. Fair enough. Because, I mean, I you know, somewhere I hit it too, and to do, you know, to think out loud too much of the folks is not giving really any information, but to whet their appetites as well, it would not do them harm if they're interested to take a look along those lines. And that would even make more sense because, in a way, why would anyone in a high military position during the time of war want to jump sides unless there was what? An economic advantage. You don't do it because all of a sudden you think the other side's really right. Screw that. No, of course not. It's like, where can I come out and make the most money?
Like John Walker during the Walker spy scandal involving the Soviets. It was about the money.
Show me the money. Okay, well, I mean, that's giving people food for thought, if in fact they want to think, and we hope that they do. But, I mean, yeah, you know, great. Benedict Arnold, you know, we think it's all about causes. Bullshit. It was about money. Jeez.
And the reason I say thinking out loud is because if I don't know, I'm going to just say I don't know. I don't want to blow smoke.
No, but I think I probably kind of breached that in a sense where I wouldn't put the blame on you. But, again, like I said, the fact that I think he wanted to be involved. And what I'm saying is that probably most of the colonization by the British Empire was done through their mercantile arm, which is the British East Indies Company.
And, Al, there's an old saying, too. The business of America is business.
Well, that ties into the City of London because they funded these things. And, in fact, they're the ones that are saying we are running that show. Okay? So that goes back to what all we've been talking about, the City of London and the British East Indies. I hate keep saying that damn word, British East Indies Company. But doesn't that make sense? I mean, it
makes total sense.
It's all about mercantilism. So what did Arnold want? Did Arnold want to, like, be on the side of the right? Of course not. He wanted the money. All right. So anyway, we broached that, and we're not going to pin that to the wall, and I'll take that on myself. But, I mean, what you just said in these last few minutes and what I've talked about haphazardly about, well, you know, it's all about the money. Well, in fact, you just kind of nailed it. So we will look into that factor. But, again, let's think about it today. Why would anybody jump sides unless there was going to be a financial inducement to it? Well said.
Good question. Well, I will leave it. I will close on this that Arnold was from Norwich. He was a local boy, and he did get involved with commerce at a very early age.
Okay, so what do we hate him for? Living in Connecticut or being involved in commerce?
Maybe both.
Both. Okay. All right, Eric.
But yeah, I'd like to get more into the machinations of for a future installment. I'd like to get more into machinations between Washington and Arnold. And I'm still trying to find a link between the Vatican and more of the revolutionary intrigues, particularly, like we mentioned last time, the Treaty of Tripoli, where they came right out and said the United States was not founded on Christian principles.
That's what you said last time out.
Yes.
So it behooved America to say that they're not involved, I mean, they're not based on Christianity when it worked for them with other dealings. And, of course, other, right. You know, at other times they bring out the Christian heart and hide behind it. Eric the Blacksmith, thank you very much for an extended Phantasms 13. Woo! And
you're welcome, Al.
Yeah, and we look forward to what we know there's going to be a next time. See you then.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.